molecules, our carbohydrates, our proteins, our nucleic acids, our fats, they all get modified by free radicals, which are created just by the fact that we're alive and burning fuel. And those free radicals have a negative impact on the organization and the flow of our biochemistry because it modifies them. And therefore, they're not the same, and they don't plug into the system in the same fashion. Mm-hmm. And it's those free radicals and associated inflammation that's behind aging and all age-related illnesses. So things like, you know, cognitive dysfunction, Alzheimer's, or cardiovascular disease, or immunological disorders, or all the autoimmune. We all have free radicals playing a fundamental role in how the system is behaving or misbehaving.
Mm-hmm. And they're all inflammatory.
Free radicals, they have three main functions, really. On the one hand, they cause damage because of their reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, they change molecules that are out there kind of like canaries in the coal mine, in that they serve as indicators that change is happening, and that change is perturbing the flow and in turn increasing free radical production, which then hits these canary bird-like protein molecules, which change their activity.
Mm-hmm.
And their changes are attempts by the flow to reestablish harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that can lead to things like cell division, cell repair, or cell death.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as all of those things happen at the right time in the right place, then you have health. And if they're happening at the wrong time in the wrong place, then you have various forms of disorder, of unhealth.
Are there ways to test the body for free radical levels to see if you are beginning to get disorder within your body?
Well, there are a number of ways that you can look at either them directly or their consequences in terms of changing all of our important biological molecules.
Just to go back to when you were mentioning the pharmaceutically created created cannabinoids, would those be exocannabinoids or?
Yeah, they're because they're produced outside. And in some cases, they could be the same or similar in that they might be modifications of the natural ones we produce. So this would be one category of synthetics. Other ones would be synthesized and look more like the plant cannabinoids, which look different than the endos that we produce, but function the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could be whole new structures that man has identified as having the capacity to bind and activate or inactivate, because scientifically you use all of those parameters in different ways to try and dissect the biochemistry and figure out what's going on. So you use things that turn it on, they're called agonists, and you use things that turn it off, turn it, meaning the receptors of the system, and those are called antagonists.
So why is it that when marijuana is used, it's psychologically active, but when you have endocannabinoids in your body, it doesn't seem to have the same kind of an effect?
Well, that's not correct, really.
Mm.
So as I was saying before, you have to look at everything from the perspective of a balance of opposing forces. So what that's telling you is all of the physiological parameters that occur when someone gets, quote, high,
mm-hmm.
those are simply extensions or inhibitions, both, combinations of both, of different parameters that are communicating as a result of being part of the endocannabinoid system.
And so does that mean that the more someone feels high, the more they're imbalanced in their body?
Well, again, there's direction. So we all oscillate with kind of our own unique average level of being high. And if we're feeling particularly good, then we're feeling higher. And if we're feeling particularly bad, then we're feeling lower. So we all have a thermostat that reflects our level of highness. And what cannabis does is it shifts you more in the direction of being higher, which includes, you know, these horrendous effects of euphoria, you know, of increased, we tend to actually be more alive.
Mm.
because it's when you turn on your endocannabinoid system, in general, what it's doing is it's promoting growth and health.
Mm-hmm. What would you say accounts for people feeling anxiety when they use cannabis?
Well, again, it's this matter of the thermostat, so that if your levels are and your flow, the settings of all of these interacting thermostats are at one point with respect to things like paranoia or the lack thereof. It's another balancing act, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you initially take cannabis, and especially if you don't take too much, what you do is you wind up increasing your sense of peace and calm and security, whereas if you take too much, now the system tries to do the opposite. To bring you back in line, essentially. So paranoia and fear are typically the result of taking too much or of taking the wrong strain, because different combinations of cannabinoids can either promote or inhibit that phenotype, that behavioral outcome.
Mm-hmm. Somewhere I heard that the cannabidiol helps to balance out the effects of the THC, and if there's not enough cannabidiol, that can be a cause for anxiety. Have you come across that research?
Yes, that's true, because in large part, cannabidiol, and you've got to keep in mind, the endocannabinoid system is incredibly complicated, as you might expect from the fact that it's regulating everything. It's got to be complicated to try and regulate everything in a way that makes sense
mm-hmm.
to the entities, to the collection of molecules. You know, in terms of survival.
Now, with respect to cancer, what kind of things are being discovered, connections between cannabis and cancer?
Well, it was back in 1975 that scientists discovered that marijuana extract at that point, well, maybe it was THC, I forgot. It might have just been THC. That it inhibits a cell line, Lewis lung cell line, in, I think it was rats. It was rats and mice, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they transplanted the tumors in. But then all of work in that direction for a number of, actually decades, largely stopped, which alone was pretty twisted, you know. It's kind of ironic that we had an insane president that we had to fire, Nixon, who started two wars. He started the war on cancer, and he started the war on drugs, but really the war on marijuana, because he didn't like hippies protesting Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so now we have a private army, and we go off and we start wars all over the world, but we don't have the protests because it's not everybody's lives that are being impacted. It's the volunteers, you know, and their families that are out there getting screwed.
Mm-hmm. So what types of cancers is it being shown that cannabis is
right.
is good for treating?
Well, what happened was back, I think one of the things that really triggered it off was Manuel Guzman, his laboratory in Spain, showed that it kills glioma cells and did some very nice dramatic experiments where they injected glioma, which is a form of brain cancer, into mice. And rats, and what they showed was that if you injected THC right into the tumor,
mm-hmm.
You had increased survival and apparently in some cases cures of that tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And that, along with future work exploring that and other cancers, at this point, from a scientific perspective, in peer-reviewed studies, looking in either animals or in tissue culture, not human clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
You see that, be it endocannabinoids, phytocannabinoids, or synthetic cannabinoids, because they're all used differently by different folks,
mm-hmm.
different scientists, what you see is they kill not only brain cancer, but skin cancer, melanoma, leukemia, lymphoma, breast cancer, prostate cancer, sarcoma, you know, on and on. So they seem to kill pretty much all cancers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think back to what I was saying about how cannabinoids regulate everything,
mm-hmm.
what that means is that you're changing the entire body's biochemistry in a fashion that, in addition to the direct killing properties of some of these cannabinoids that you see in say, for example, a cell culture, that when you put back the complexity of the organism and you put back the immune system and the endocrine system and everything else, and you re-regulate that by increasing cannabinoid levels, you actually create an environment that, rather than providing nourishment and support for the cancer cell, does the opposite. So on the one hand, you attack the biochemistry of the cancer cell, and on the other hand, you modify the environment so that the cancer cell is no longer being supported, and you have what's then a holistic interaction by increasing cannabinoids and inhibiting the growth and spread of tumors. It not only kills the cancer cells, but it actually modifies the biochemistry of the organism in a fashion that inhibits metastasis, the spread of the cancer.
So in what ways has this been proven? This is in vitro studies, in vivo studies?
Those are in vitro and in situ, you know, in animals, et cetera. But what's happened, and it's really quite an amazing thing, started by Rick Simpson up in Canada, a decade or more ago, when he found that he was able to cure his skin cancer by making cannabis-based extracts, and subsequently treating numerous people with numerous, not only cancers, but other illnesses, and finding amazingly beneficial results and actually curative properties for a number of cancers when people go on this high-dose therapy. And what's been so amazing is that, aside from that, a layman has discovered what will, at this point, what appears to be a cure for cancer, for a number of cancers, for a number of individuals. It doesn't work for everybody all the time. Everybody's got to be clear on that, you know, especially if people have poisoned their bodies too much with chemotherapy, which intrinsically not only targets the cancer, but basically poisons the whole body, which is why it has so many negative side effects. So, but nevertheless, what we're seeing in particular in medical marijuana states, where people have the option to try these things in a way that they're really not able to get the quantities and the dosages that are needed for these cancer treatments. They're very high doses. You know, myself, as a person who started exploring cannabis when I was 16, when I first started college down in New York City, what used to be Hunter in the Bronx, the cannabis, for me, played a very important part in my awakening to what an idiot I was, and it made me realized that if I'm going to school, I should be studying harder and working harder, and as a result, I became a pathological lifelong learner. So it tends to do exactly the opposite of what the prohibitionists say. You know, they tell you it's going to destroy your brain. Well, in fact, you know, it actually is very much involved in the synthesis and regeneration and protection of our nervous system and our nerve cells. So it's quite amazing.
I heard that the National Institute of Health has a patent on cannabinoids and being used as a neuroprotectant. Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, nobody's challenged it. That's just got to be BS because it's been used for various medical applications, some of which ultimately manifest as neuroprotection for, you know, centuries. Medical marijuana was first talked about 3000 BC in the first Chinese pharmacopoeia that was ever written about how it did different things.
So the patent application exists. You're just saying that it's not valid for them to have a patent on it.
Yeah, it's BS because prior art. You can't get, you have to discover something new.
Right.
You know, as if people were using cannabis for multiple sclerosis and epilepsy and all of these things for hundreds of years, you know, pain modification, et cetera, you know, it becomes what's called prior art.
But that seems that it could be used as an argument that the government recognizes there is medicinal value to cannabis, therefore it should be rescheduled.
Well, you know, you'd have to be an idiot at this point if you had any kind of education regarding peer-reviewed scientific literature to come to the conclusion that marijuana has no value, you have to be, you know, insane. It's ridiculous.
Can you give us an idea of how many peer-reviewed papers there are regarding cannabis and its medicinal effects?
Well, I have a subset on my computer, and my subset is largely more hardcore science than a lot of these looser sciences like sociological implications and interpretations, et cetera. So what I call the hardcore biochemistry, molecular biology, genetics, et cetera, of cannabinoids and the cannabinoid system, I've got close to 10,000. I've got around over 600 that are specific just to cannabinoids and cancer.
Wow.
And of those 600, all except for about four are coming from one laboratory with one cell line. Other than those four or so, all the rest show cancer-killing properties.
Hmm. Just to go back to the mice, you were saying that they were injected with cancer. So cancer is something that can be injected into an organism?
Yeah, you can inject cancer cells, and then those cancer cells take hold, you know. It's
mm-hmm.
just like a metastasis, essentially. But in this case, it's to another organism. So that actually complicated some of the interpretations of Manuel Guzman's first studies, because you were injecting human cancers into rats, so you would expect there to be an immunological response, recognizing not necessarily just the cancer, but recognizing that it's a foreign tissue from another organism.
Mm-hmm.
But that's subsequently been expanded on just tremendously. I mean, we know a lot of the specific mechanisms involved in killing the cancers in cell lines, which, again, is different than the holistic killing of a curing of a cancer in an organism.
Now, when they talk about the THC that they then inject into the mice to stop the cancer, is this a synthesized THC? Is this an extract from the marijuana plant?
It's a semi-synthetic. They if I understand correctly, they extract a precursor molecule that's found in sufficient abundance, and then that gets modified into THC.
And that precursor molecule comes from a cannabis plant?
Yeah, so it's a semi-synthetic THC.
Hmm.
It can be made either way. Largely, I would say, if you have THC, the identical molecule in isomeric form, it doesn't know where it came from.
Mm-hmm. And then with Rick Simpson's work, couldn't that be argued that it's best case series? Have you heard of that term?
Best case scenario?
I was listening to Dr. John Apsley, and he was saying that if someone has been diagnosed as stage 4, in the disease, that they are terminal and there's nothing more the medical society can do for them, and then they become cured, and that happens repeatedly with different patients, you wouldn't have to go through the FDA process to prove that your methods are effective. And
what we've been doing now is basically using Rick Simpson's protocol. I speak with Rick regularly. We have documented now medically where you have a previous official medical diagnosis that a person has a particular cancer and staging, et cetera, and then you treat them with cannabis, and then the cancer goes away, and you have biopsies that show the cancer is now gone. So we are accumulating that kind of data now in Colorado and in other places, and eventually, I'm CEO and president of a publicly traded company, Cannabis Science, CBIS, on the stock exchange. And what we're trying to do is raise sufficient money to go through the FDA with some specific examples of cancer cures and other types of cures, help rather than cures, always for things like PTSD and chronic pain, as is in particular causing the greatest cause of death of our soldiers right now is suicide, not Afghanistan or Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And cannabis works effectively, more so than other things. It doesn't make it go away. It's not like it's a real cure for the PTSD. But we did a survey of a number of veterans, and it's pretty universally accepted by people with PTSD that cannabis helps relieve a number of the problems, like intrusive memories, the inability to sleep, irritability, things like that. Cannabis is very effective for. So why do we trust soldiers to go off and fight and protect our freedom, and then they come back and they say, I have this problem, it's medically diagnosed, science tells you why cannabis works for it. They tell you, the people who we trust so much and honor so much, they tell us this is what works, and the government says tough shit.
Let's see, the people who have cancer and are in a state that doesn't allow this medical marijuana, can they go to Colorado to get treated for their cancer?
Not easily at this point, because you have to become a Colorado resident. So if you have an address that you can use and you trade in your license, then you can do that.
Mm-hmm. And then what is the cost that for this kind of treatment? From, I know there's different people who are producing the Rick Simpson oil. So are there different prices with different groups?
There are. In general, you need about a little less, but approximately, you know, a pound to 2 pounds of starting material, and what you want to start with is high-quality bud, in particular indica, not sativa, seems to be more efficient, based on Rick's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that the price for that varies, but in general, it's going to cost you a couple thousand dollars to hopefully get rid of your cancer.
And so is that, in that scenario, would the patient have to create the medicine themselves, or is that where they go and they buy it already prepared?
It depends on, you know, where you are. If you're not in a medical marijuana state that allows extracts, then you have to do it on the black market, and you'll do it yourself, typically.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you can go to dispensaries in Colorado and pick up, you know, varying grades depending on the care of the people who are producing it.
And so what is the oil is being used for, or the active ingredients, I should say, in the oil, is that just THC, or is it the other cannabinoids?
No, it's the whole constellation of them, because for example, cannabidiol actually winds up inhibiting a lot of the direct CB1-related activity, which may, in fact, be part of its effectiveness, because that would shift some of the activity towards the CB2 receptor, which often seems to be more involved in some of the cancer-killing properties. But again, you know, it seems to be that we are all idiosyncratic, us as individuals, and that different strains, because of there being about 100 cannabinoids, as well as other biologically important compounds, flavonoids, et cetera, in the plant, that different strains have different ratios and different people have different needs. So
mm-hmm.
if you're sick and you're lucky, you find the right strain that works very well for your particular condition. In general, though, for these cancer treatments, you wind up needing, again, you know, fairly large, large dose, and you work your way up to that gram a day incrementally as your body adapts.
About how many grams does a person take for the treatment, and how does that convert into ounces?
They're taking probably the equivalent of about a half ounce a day of Primo Bud.
But, I'm sorry, what is the amount of oil, that concentrated oil that they're taking throughout the course of the treatment?
You know, at least the grams, the 2 grams are the doses that I've seen people take. And if you wind up taking that, it's a pretty intense dose, so you wind up having to incrementally work your way up to it.
And then throughout the course of the treatment, how many grams total would that be?
You know, 60, 90 grams of what we call the tar. It's more accurate than calling it the oil.
Mm-hmm. And what would the equivalent of 60 to 90 grams be in an English measurement?
Well, that's what I'm saying. You need a pound or two.
Okay.
Of starting material that you then extract.
Well, how much of the tar would that be?
60 to 90 grams.
In English units, or, you know, the English measurement?
Oh, pounds are the English units. Kilograms are the more standard unit, and it's 2.2 pounds to a kilogram. So you need a little less than a kilo.
But I mean of the tar, not the starting material. Or it would be a kilo of tar that you're taking.
You're taking 60 to 90 grams mm-hmm. of tar. It's 32 ounces in a gram. I mean, there are 32 grams in an ounce.
Okay. So that's about 2 ounces to 2 to 3 ounces of the tar.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I heard you speaking with another person about echinacea being something that works on the endocannabinoid system or as a precursor to the endocannabinoid system.
Seems to actually activate the CB2 receptor, which is the main immunologically active cannabinoid pattern of altering biochemistry through CB2 receptors. And echinacea seems to have compounds that interact with that, as potentially do a number of other herbal compounds, although I recently read there's some controversy regarding some of the earlier findings.
And the echinacea would be the earlier findings?
No, I think the echinacea one has held up.
Okay.
I'm quite certain of that, but some of the other ones, it's not as clear anymore. You know, polyphenols from tea and different other compounds.
And so how many cannabinoids are there in the marijuana plant?
There's about 100.
Mm-hmm. And are they all known, or some of them are still...
Well, the 100 are the ones that have been identified.
That's
how you know you got that many, you know.
I see.
And that includes cannabidiol, cannabinol, THC, and THCV, THC, you know, by a variety of chemical modifications on that general plant structure, ring structure, terpene ring structure.
So as far as the Rick Simpson oil is concerned, are they using, are the active ingredients in all parts of the plant or only in the bud?
They're most prevalent in the bud. But, you know, if you think about it from a botanical point of view, a bud is a modified leaf. And if you look at, you know, a nice plant growing properly, by the time you're ready to harvest the bud, the leaves are coated with, you know, trichomes and just sparkling.
Mm-hmm. And so
you can make hash out of that and extract out of that as well.
Are there different cannabinoids in different parts of the plant? Like there's a concentration of certain ones in the bud, different ones in the stem, different ones in the leaf, different ones in the root?
Well, there are different cannabinoids and biologically active compounds other than cannabinoids that are differentially distributed. If you're looking at THC, though, or CBD, those are especially produced in the trichomes,
mm-hmm.
as are really most of the others. So I'm not sure how, for example, because the roots have historically been documented to have medicinal value. And those were typically acquired by boiling the roots, if I'm remembering correctly. So that would imply that you had some water-soluble compounds, and most of your cannabinoids are very hydrophobic. They don't like water.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure about how those are produced or if they're transported to different parts of the plant.
And do you
That's
know
something I should look into. I don't know that answer accurately.
And do you know what the root was being used to treat traditionally?
I think it's psychoarthritis, if I'm remembering correctly.
Okay, so it's an anti-inflammatory compound.
Yeah, they would make poultices out of it.
Uh-huh.
I have to look into that more.
Well, let me tell the listening audience now that if you'd like to give a call to the station and ask Dr. Melamed a question about any of this that we're talking about, give us a call. The telephone number here is area code 315-859-4200. So that's 315-859-4200. And another question I have for you is you had mentioned that there are some cannabinoids that aren't psychoactive. Could you talk about that?
Well, most of them aren't.
Okay.
You know, the only one, the hardcore is the THC, and THCV seems to have some. And cannabidiol, in that it has antidepressive properties, anti-paranoia properties. You know, when you take too much of your cannabinoids and you exhibit that biphasic response that we were mentioning, where it kind of does the opposite thing at one dose as it does at another dose. So the real main psychoactive one is THC. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. And can this medicine be used to treat something like osteoporosis or osteonecrosis?
Well, once again, everything's a balance of opposing forces. So everything in our body is constantly in a state of synthesis versus degradation. We do both all the time. And osteoporosis is when your imbalance favors degradation as opposed to synthesis with respect to the bone and cartilage. Well, the bone specifically, if it's osteo. But it seems that that balancing act is regulated by, in bones, by both the CB1 and the CB2 receptor, and it's the appropriate balance of activity that is important.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that cannabis has osteoporotic properties,
mm-hmm.
and you know, again, it's just like everything else, it's regulating everything in your body, and when you have the right shift, you get benefits, and the wrong shift, you don't, and it seems that cannabis, like with everything else, has these anti-aging properties, because the more you have inflammation, the more you tend to promote degradation rather than synthesis, and the older you get, the more you start to shift your biochemistry away from the balance of youth. Well, actually, youth is an imbalance because you're growing all the time. Then you reach adulthood and you stop growing, and now we start to accumulate the consequences of our biological friction, the free radicals, and the system no longer operates as efficiently, and that's what aging is, the accumulation of the movement towards equilibrium, which is death,
mm-hmm.
a phase change.
In Rick Simpson's work, he's found a way for people to extract the THC from the plant in an at-home setting. Is there a layman's way to extract the non-psychoactive compounds for medicinal use?
Well, once you've extracted the psychoactives, then that's what you're left with. So it depends on how you pull things out. You know, you could make, for example, you could do a ice water extract and pull off all the trichomes, and then the plant that you'd be left with would not have all of those cannabinoids that came out when you made your hash, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And under those circumstances, then you'd have everything else left that you could extract by different means.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about people that want to use the plant to treat cancers and things like that? Is it as effective to smoke the plant as it is to eat the concentrate of it?
No, I don't think so. Smoking, I mean, it's going to be good for you have lung cancer, you're bathing those cells in it, so it can both be effective there.
We have a caller, if you could hold that thought.
Mm-hmm. So what we'd like to do is shift our thermostat a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And evidence for that need is shown by the health beneficial effects of things like omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils and things, which happen to be made into our endocannabinoids.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what we understand as health benefits are attained by essentially upregulating our endocannabinoid activity. So what I'm saying is that we can't evolutionarily adapt quick enough right now in order to reset that thermostat and increase our endocannabinoid tone.
Mm-hmm.
So the easiest way to do that is, on the one hand, to take fish oils and essential fatty acids that is found in also hemp oil, for example,
mm-hmm.
but to further supplement with active cannabinoids,
mm-hmm.
so that we shift that biochemical balance and are able to participate in the benefits of using the these anti-aging compounds to inhibit the age-related diseases. Again, cardiovascular disease, neurological dysfunction, hormonal dysfunction, bone dysfunction, cancers, etc. So it's now, for modern man, an essential nutrient.
Uh-huh. And so do you think supplementing with this will have a long-term effect on our evolution?
I think what it's going to do is foster man's movement in a correct direction, in a more beneficial direction. Again, this is what I call the blip-flip hypothesis, backward-looking people versus forward-looking people. Again, a balancing act, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need them both. It's where is the thermostat set?
Mm-hmm.
And right now, our governments, I believe in general and historically, have been run by blips, backward-looking people who, in general, are very conservative, and they want the future to look more like the past because of their cannabinoid deficiency, which, you got to remember, you can have people who are cannabinoid endowed with respect to things like open-mindedness, positive thinking, optimism. Those are characteristics of cannabis users, documented, versus another section of the population that will be lower than average in their activity. And so we have flips and blips. Forward-looking people who are cannabinoid endowed, they're higher people, and unhigh people who are cannabinoid deficient. And I maintain it's the unhigh people that, through aggression and uniformity of thought, because they want the future to be the past,
mm-hmm.
that those are the people that run the world. And if you look back at the history of power in the world, with the exception of Mahatma Gandhi, we had a bunch of flaming lunatics running the world.
Mm-hmm. So do you also think, based on that, I know we haven't talked about this yet, but I've heard you talk before about how essential fatty acids are a precursor to cannabinoids in the body?
Mm-hmm.
So could it be that people that have a diet that's rich in these foods tend to be forward-looking people?
Well, you would hope so. It all depends where they started.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's going to increase their cannabinoid tone. But where they fall in terms of being above or below average, that may not be as critical, a critical determinant. It'll push them in the right direction, as evidenced by increased health,
mm-hmm.
by antidepressive activity even of essential fatty acids like omega-3s.
Mm-hmm. And I also heard you speak in another venue about cannabis or cannabinoids. When they're eaten, they go into the intestines and then directly to the lymph system. Any more to say about that?
Well, just that you get liver metabolites occurring that have some different properties. So, as well as in terms of clearance time and rapidity of onset, you smoke it, it hits you quickly. You tend to spike in about, half hour and then decline over the next hour to hour and a half. Whereas when you eat it, you have a much less peaky, more sustained feeling that is more encompassing the whole body. I find it to be less impairing and more pleasant. And for me, I would say it seems to be more healthful.
Mm-hmm. And I also heard you talk a little bit about bird flu in relation to cannabis. Would you like to reiterate that information?
Yeah, it turns out that the bird flu, which kills around 60-70% of the people who get it, fortunately they don't get it from direct transfer, it's only coming from animals at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They die typically from organ failure, specifically the lungs. They get what's called ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is really a cataclysmic collapse of the lung due to the death of the respiratory epithelial cells by a process known as apoptosis. It's basically when the cells are stressed beyond their ability to maintain their organization, and then they unwind their organization.
Mm-hmm.
And studies have shown, and of course they're always interpreted in a politically correct manner rather than in what I would say is a sane fashion, they emphasized how there was a higher viral load after they treated infected mice with these excessively pro-inflammatory strains that lead to this ARDS, adult respiratory distress syndrome. So that was the emphasis of their finding, was that there was an increased viral load. But the other half of what their story showed, which was more important, was that it decreased the cell death of the respiratory epithelial cells. So to me, that means you have a choice. You could either have fewer viruses and be dead or have more viruses and be alive.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the choice is pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
So I would recommend to people from a scientific point of view, because again, I'm not a medical doctor, I'm a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So I only share my scientific knowledge, really. But it seems that, and I've personally experienced this as well, that if you eat cannabis when you get the flu, for most people, it'll decrease those inflammatory-related symptoms and cell death, and actually help promote the kind of what's called humoral immunity, antibody-based immunity that can help fight that that infection. And again, in so many illnesses, it's our body's response that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
We have an overactive immune response that leads to autoimmune diseases or that leads to ARDS. So, again, it's a matter of finding the right balance for inflammation. And in our modern era, it seems, once again, that for most illnesses, that thermostat is set too high.
Well, I'll give you one last comment. If you have anything you'd like to mention that we didn't cover, feel free to enlighten us.
Well, simply that all of us, especially the young people, and I say the young people because, there's that saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. That probably has to do with the lack of cannabinoid activity. So when you're young and embracing change, that's the time to get out there and to, make the best of your life and your efforts to change the world in a good fashion, intelligent fashion. And think of how insane it is that we've outlawed a cancer-killing anti-aging plant that, by the way, and we haven't gone into this, is found in mother's milk.
Mm-hmm.
It's in mother's milk, psychoactive cannabinoids. So you protect the brain, you stimulate the appetite, you relax the kid after getting his skull crunched for, tens of hours often during childbirth.
Mm.
They're exposed to toxic oxygen once they come out. They need protection. So how could any sane society outlaw what's in mother's milk? And along those lines, maybe we should be arresting nursing mothers because they're getting their kids high.
Mm-hmm.
And with that logic, maybe we should just arrest all women for walking around with paraphernalia.
Hmm. Well, that's pretty crazy laws that we have, and hopefully they'll change.
Well, it's the blips and flips. If you're a forward-looking cannabinoid-endowed person, get out there and change this insanity and make sure you vote, and we vote for people that have cannabis-friendly positions, and we dump the idiots that have run the world, because we need to change the world if mankind is to survive. We have to be responsive to our environmentally induced changes. We can't just stick our head in our butt or in a hole in the ground like our politicians continuously do. It's time for change. It's time to replace blips with flips, and it's up to all of us to make that happen.
Thank you so much, Dr. Melamed, for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Take care.
You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye now.